Good afternoon. I will call to order this meeting of the House Commerce Committee, and I will ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watun.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Here.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Lilly.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Present.
And I'll call again Representative Haley.
A quorum is present. Sorry for the ambush, but Representative Cotiza Watun, would you be willing to move the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Cotiza Watun moves the approval of our minutes from January 12, 2021. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? And we will approve the minutes from January 12, 21. We are in the second of a series of overview hearings concerning the jurisdiction of our committee. Today, our subjects will be insurance, broadly defined, which is sort of at the core of the Commerce Committee's jurisdiction, followed by a presentation from the Attorney General's office on their consumer protection functions. But we will start with a presentation from House Research on Minnesota's insurance markets. And so I will turn the floor to Ms. Pompu.
Chair and members, my name is Laurie Pompu. I am the House Research Department Analyst for the Commerce Committee, and I am just going to do a brief run through of some more popular topics in insurance that we cover here at the Commerce Committee. Basically, auto, homeowners, long-term care, and health insurance. Auto insurance in Minnesota is mandatory. There is a no-fault provision, which includes benefits that you would receive from your insurance company if you're injured. It includes a liability portion, which covers situations where you need to pay for damage to someone else or their property, and underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage, which provides coverage to you in situations where the person you're in an accident with doesn't have enough liability insurance or isn't insured. Minnesota also regulates through its auto insurance statutes rideshare companies like Lyft and Uber, and what type of insurance they have and when that type of insurance applies when someone's using their personal vehicle for business use. And then on to homeowners insurance and property, casualty, fire, those are all types of property insurance. Minnesota, like for auto insurance, has a guarantee fund that will help people if they need homeowners insurance but can't find it somewhere else. And we do regulate what can be included and what type of underwriting can be used. And then on to life insurance. The state regulates group and individual life insurance products, what has to be included in the policy, the readability of the policy, how you could package life insurance with other types of investments, how you can't package life insurance with other types of investments. And then on to long-term care insurance, next to life. Minnesota regulates long-term care insurance. It also has a statutory structure for qualified long-term care insurance, which is a type of tax-benefited long-term care insurance where the person gets to deduct their premiums from their taxes if they meet other qualifications. And then on to the big one, health insurance. We have several different types of entities in Minnesota that provide health insurance. We have health carriers under Chapter 60A and 62A that provide health insurance, and that's what people typically think of when they think of health insurance. You know, you pay a premium, they insure you with the amount of coverage. It's just a relationship between you and them. Possibly your employer's involved, but it's kind of straight through. We also regulate nonprofit health service plan corporations, which is Blue Cross Blue Shield. We also, as a state, regulate health maintenance organizations. Those are overseen by the Department of Health, but the mandates and insurance requirements that we draft for insurance companies loop in HMOs as well. And they have an interagency agreement between Commerce and Health to do the rate review process for HMOs as well. So it ends up in our bag of interest as well. And so those are the three main types of entities that provide health insurance. And then I'm going to go on to types of health insurance that are sold. The big categories are individual health insurance, sold on the marketplace. That can be for a person or a person and their family. It's still individual. Small group insurance, which is 50 or less employees or persons pulled together, buying their insurance from an HMO or a health carrier. And then we have large group insurance, which is 51 or more persons or employees, again, buying their insurance through a health carrier and pulled together. We also have, because it's come up quite a bit last year and this year, I wanted to touch on short-term limited duration insurance policies, which are a type of individual health insurance policy that are exempt from many state and federal requirements. And these are 6 months in length and have limitations on renewability under state law. So for all those types of insurance, we regulate what kind of illnesses have to be covered, what kind of providers you're allowed to see, what diseases we require treatment for. We also regulate what an insurance company can take into consideration when they're deciding how much your policy costs. That brings me to my handout on health insurance. I believe that Addy distributed this to you. It's just a list of health insurance terms. It's mostly major federal laws that intersect with health insurance. So we have the definition of COBRA here, which everyone should know is...
Bonfu, if I could just interject briefly, because we're early in session and we're all getting used to the new normal. The virtual the equivalent of having the folder in the room is your Outlook calendar invite. So that's where you would find the handout if you are looking for the handout that's being referenced here.
Yeah, there's an older version online, but I updated it for our review of just complex federal laws and ideas that intersect health insurance. Good to know about. So yes, COBRA, it's, you know, when someone leaves their place of employment, they can continue health insurance through their employer. They will end up paying the employer side of the premium and how long that they can keep that in place and information they have to receive about that when they leave employment. Also, multiple employer welfare arrangements, MEWAs. This is when several different groups of employers pool together to purchase health insurance. This came up recently. Legislation was passed to allow agricultural cooperatives like Land of Lakes to run a MEWA and move their suppliers into a pool to have health insurance. And then something that comes up a lot, we have ERISA, so the Employment Retirement Income Security Act. Is involved in self-insured health plans. So there are two types of health insurance. Generally, there are fully insured health plans, which is what I've talked about. It's regulated by the state. It's where you and your employer have a relationship with a health insurance company. You pay them a specific amount of money. And for that year, they cover what they said they're going to cover. And it's just a purchasing relationship. On the other side of that, you have ERISA or self-insured plans. In that situation, your employer or whoever is running your group has a trust account. And when you pay your premium, they take your money and put it in their trust account. They hire someone like Blue Cross, Blue Shield. You know, they work both as an insurer and as an administrator. So Blue Cross may be your administrator. They may be the person that deals with claims and processing. So it feels like you pay a premium to them. But in fact, you are self-insured. So the claims that you file come out of that trust account and are paid directly by your employer. Another term talked about in here is stop loss insurance, because the question with a bank account always comes up, what if the group uses all the money? You know, why? What protections do you have if you have a self-insured situation and you have a bad year and everyone's very ill and they use up all the money in the trust account? Stop loss insurance is something that self-insured entities purchase so that if they do have a very bad year, they have a secondary type of insurance that kicks in and will allow the people that they're providing insurance to be covered for the rest of that year. So it only comes up on that self-insured area, and there's lots of talk about how to price it and how to price it for different groups of people, because it can be one of the gateways to determining whether you want to self-insure or not. The state of Minnesota self-insures, the University of Minnesota self-insures, 3M self-insures. And as of 2017, 38% of the state was self-insured. 20% were in that fully insured group, and the remainder are public programs or uninsured. So just so you have a breakdown, and that's from the Minnesota Department of Health, Health Economics Department. And then I just had one more thing I wanted to touch on, reinsurance. So the ACA had a reinsurance program that ran until 2016, and it ended at that time. And while it was in place, states created their own reinsurance programs, and Minnesota created one shortly after the federal program ended. And this is a program that allows health insurers to be reimbursed from the state or federal government when they have very ill individuals who have high claims costs. And so our reinsurance program currently is run by the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, or MCHA, in connection with the Department of Commerce. And they file with the Department of Commerce or MCHA for reimbursement when they have a person who has over $50,000 in claims that year. And then they can be reimbursed for 80% of the amount of claims between $50,000 and $250,000. So the maximum amount that could be paid to a health insurer under the reinsurance program for an ill individual is $160,000 under the current it's called attachment point coinsurance rate and the end cap. So those are all set in statute. It's in chapter 62E. I'm happy to talk about it. And that's all I had for health insurance and auto homeowners. There are many other types of insurance, and I'm happy to talk about them all. And I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Ms. Pampu. Are there questions at this time related to that presentation? Seeing none, we do have three testifiers today from various industry segments in the insurance space. We're going to hear from all three of them, and then my hope is they will stay in the Zoom for questions at the end of all three. So if members have questions, feel free to raise your hand at any time, but I'm not going to take any questions until all three have completed their testimony. And we will start with Dan Andreessen from the health plans.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see my screen?
We do, yes.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen. I'm the Senior Director of Policy and Government Affairs with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans.
Hi, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Eric Lara, Director of Health Policy and Government Affairs for the Council. So the goal of today's presentation is to provide you with a basic overview of the health insurance market in Minnesota. Now, before Dan dives into the specifics about health insurance, I'd like to quickly talk about the council and its members. So the Minnesota Council of Health Plans is a trade association that brings seven nonprofit health plans together. You can see their logos on your screen right now. It is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Hennepin Health, Medica, Preferred One, Sanford Health, and UCare. And to give you an idea of how big our footprint is in Minnesota, the health plans employ together over 40,000 Minnesotans around the state. In 2019 alone, 4.7 million people got their health insurance through one of our health plan members. And altogether, they reimbursed providers around $25.7 billion in medical claims that same year. Lastly, the key difference that sets our member health plans apart from other health insurance companies in the market is that they are all nonprofit carriers. This means that they disclose their operational and financial information to the public, they don't have any shareholders, and in turn do not build profit margins into their premiums.
So let's go into what health insurance does. And health insurance is about spreading out individual costs to a broader population. So access to care is more affordable, whether it's routine care or emergency situations, very similar to what we've been seeing with the COVID situation. We do this by pooling people together to spread out enrollee costs, especially to benefit those who require greater utilization of healthcare. And pooling people together also has the advantage of maximizing buying power so plans can negotiate better prices from providers. And these premiums that are paid by enrollees is a reflection of the cost of healthcare. And the role of the plan is to provide enrollees access to this high quality care at the best possible value. So let's look and see how this plays out. And we've all been through this before, so this is going to be no surprise to any of you. An enrollee signs up for a plan and pays a monthly premium to that plan. Throughout the year, that enrollee now can seek care through a doctor, hospital, or pharmacy when needed. After those services are provided, the provider submits a claim to the health plan for that enrollee, and it's then determined what the enrollee pays out of pocket for this care based on their insurance plan. Now, the enrollee will receive an explanation of benefits, sometimes called an EOB, in the mail, and then also a bill from the provider. Now, behind the scenes, the health plan, sometimes called the payer in this situation, uses those funds that are collected by premiums to reimburse the provider at that contracted rate. And so, as was mentioned, health plans are a regulated industry, both the state and federal levels. And in order for a health plan to offer their insurance products, they have to comply with certain requirements that show that they're capable of taking on the financial responsibility of covering their enrollees. And here are just a couple I wanted to highlight for you. One is actuarial soundness. Now, during the rate review process, regulators will examine proposed premiums to ensure that they're sufficient to pay all claims and they're not unreasonably high in relation to the benefits being provided. Now, regulators also examine solvency to make sure that the health insurance plan can meet all of its financial obligations. And this includes scrutiny of the amount of funding that a health plan may keep in reserves to pay for unanticipated claims or a rapid change in the market. Yesterday, you talked briefly about medical loss ratio. This is the minimum percentage of health plan premiums must be spent on healthcare services. And when these thresholds are not met, enrollees will be issued a rebate at the end of the year. And you'll see that these percentages vary depending on the insurance market. Plans must also meet network adequacy requirements to ensure that network or providers meet standards set by regulators. And these networks must meet geographical access standards and include a sufficient number and type of providers to ensure covered services are available. And then lastly, coverage mandates. So plans must adhere to coverage mandates that are set by the Affordable Care Act and the state for coverage for inpatient, outpatient care, emergency services, prescription drugs. Now the ACA requires 10 essential health benefits. You'll sometimes hear them called EHBs. And the state of Minnesota has, on top of that, put on over 60 additional mandated health benefits. So let's talk about health insurance here in Minnesota, and I'll kind of go through this quickly because House Research just kind of covered some of this. We have our employer-sponsored plans. Those are the ones you get through your employer. As mentioned, we have our self-insured plans that are the larger employers. They're the ones taking on the financial risk for that plan, and so they're the ones setting the coverage, but they do work through an insurance company to to make it all happen. Conversely, we have the smaller plans. Those are the plans that can't take on that financial risk of an insurance plan, so they will work through insurance plan to or insurance company to provide those access to their employees. But we also have individual market. Typically, we associate that with MinSure. That's the state's marketplace for folks who want to buy individual plans and get access to premium subsidies and cost sharing reductions. But we also have folks who will buy off the exchange, either through a broker or an insurance company directly. Now, these two that are in the insurance market, along with the small and large group market, is what's called fully insured plans. That's important to define, which we'll get to here in a second. So let's kind of show the breakdown of how Minnesotans get their health coverage. And our number is a little bit different from House Research. I feel like we're within the margin of error, but at least kind of give you a idea where everyone's getting their coverage. So we have about 17% of the population, around a million folks on state public programs. I'll mention that several of our members are managed care organizations contracted with DHS to provide access to coverage for those services. We have folks in the fully employer-sponsored large and small group markets, the individual market, the MinSure market. Also want to mention CGIP, that's the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which many of you may be on. This is the state program that's run through Minnesota Management Budget Office. It operates very similar to a self-insured plan. Most of the folks in Minnesota get their access through a self-insured plan. Then we have the Medicare market, and then folks who are uninsured and not in any of those. So let's look at this chart again and how changes in state law impacts these markets. And the various markets in Minnesota are impacted by both states' changes in federal and state laws. Now, sometimes issues will arise with the health insurance that can't be solved by one of our plans or a change in state law. For example, during the session, we may hear from you or one of your colleagues who've heard from a constituent with a health insurance concern. And one of the first questions that we will have for you is, do you know where they receive their insurance coverage? Because this will determine the best course of action to find a solution. So starting over with Medicare and the self-insured markets, which are primarily governed by federal law, Medicare is a federal program. There is some state regulation when it comes to Medicaid Advantage plans, but it's primarily in the federal sphere. And then as mentioned, we have the self-insured plans, which are covered under ERISA, and you hear them often called ERISA plans. Now, because these markets are regulated federally, any changes in state laws don't impact Minnesotans in these markets. Additionally, for self-insured plans, because the employers are taking on the financial risk for the policy, they set the coverage for their employees. So going back to our constituent example, in this case, their first course of action, if they have a concern, is to go to their HR benefits department rather than the insurance company themselves. So this leaves us with those enrolled in state public programs, CGIP, and the fully insured market, which are subject to changes in state law. And this is around 44% of the population, around 2.5 million Minnesotans. And so when legislation is enacted through the legislature, which addresses coverage or health plan operations, it's only going to impact Minnesotans in these areas. Now, you will see situations where state public programs or CGIP will be exempted from legislation. This could be because the legislation doesn't apply to that population. But we've also seen situations arise because there's going to be a cost to the state in terms of fiscal note. And so for state public programs, those will come from DHS, from CGIP, it'll be MMB. And these fiscal notes are an indication to the potential cost of that proposed change. And if there's a projected cost to state public programs and CGIP, there's also going to be a cost to those in the fully insured commercial market. And as plans, we strive to for stability to keep premiums as low as possible. And as I previously mentioned, premiums is a reflection of the cost of healthcare. And we try to keep these premiums as low as possible so folks can maintain their coverage and not fall in the uninsured population. Lastly, I just want to touch also on reinsurance. I don't want to go too deep into this, but It's been a very successful program here in Minnesota. As mentioned, it's really helped stabilize the market, and it's been a good partnership between the state and the feds. Most of this is being funded by federal dollars. So it was enacted back in 2017. Minnesota was one of the first to do this, and since we have 14 other states that have kind of followed the lead of Minnesota. And we are entering the fourth year of a five-year waiver. The program is set to sunset at the end of the calendar year. The state is authorized for the fifth year, but there has to be a change in statute to keep the program going through 2022. And this table kind of just shows you deadlines that are quickly approaching for health plans, where they need to start submitting information to Commerce and MDH for their 2022 products. So we'd urge folks to take early action on this session. We are not expecting any extension to a fifth year to cost the state additional money. There should be enough money in the premium security account, which funds the program. So again, I appreciate the time you've given us today to talk about insurance here in Minnesota. Please reach out to myself or Erica or anyone else on our staff if you have any questions, and happy to take ones at the end of the presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Our next presenter is Aaron Cocking of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the chance to speak to you today. As the chairman mentioned, my name is Aaron Cocking. I'm the president and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. My guess is that those of you that have been around for any length of time remember my predecessor, Bob Johnson, who served the Insurance Federation for 43 years before retiring last year. I have taken over for him, and I look forward to working with each of you in the year and the years to come. Mr. Chairman, are you able to see my screen now?
I am.
Excellent. All right. As I mentioned, I'm Aaron Cocking. I've also got Mark Kolda, who's our Vice President of Public Affairs that works with us. The Insurance Federation of Minnesota was founded in 1914 and really exists to represent the interests of Minnesota's insurers, as well as our policyholders, to regulators, legislators, and the public. And Ms. Pompu did a good job of going through a number of things. At its base level, insurance is a contract between two parties. The transfer of risk to protect assets. In exchange for premium, our companies agree to indemnify you for losses suffered pursuant to the policy agreement. I also like to tell people, you know, insurance allows people to live a higher quality of life because of the financial protections it affords. If you think about your car or your house, for example, would you be willing to drive the car you do right now or live in the house that you do without the financial protections assured to you by insurance? I think most people, certainly myself, I would say no. I'm guessing most people don't have the financial wherewithal to be able to buy a new car if theirs was damaged or to rebuild their house without the financial protections that our products afford. There are nearly 1,000 foreign, domestic, and township mutual insurers that are operating in Minnesota. When I say foreign, I don't mean non-U.S. companies, although that is the case maybe in a few instances, but largely companies that are not domiciled in Minnesota. Minnesota has 39 Minnesota domiciled companies, as well as roughly 90 township mutuals. And obviously companies broken down between stock and mutual companies. Mutual companies referring to companies that are owned by their policyholders and that have the ability to vote and elect their own boards of directors. In Minnesota, as well as elsewhere, insurance can be sold by independent agents, captive agents, as we refer as direct writers, or obviously the growing trend of either buying your insurance online or via an app. Insurance is largely broken down between personal lines and commercial lines as far as PC insurance goes. And just at its base level, personal lines refers to insurance that covers individuals or couples against loss that results from death, injury, or loss of property. And in those cases, the named insured will be a person as opposed to a business. Think about homeowners, auto, and renters as the most prevalent examples of personal lines insurance. As Ms. Pompu referenced, auto insurance, liability auto insurance is mandated in Minnesota. We have limits, minimum limits that are required by statute, 30-60-10, meaning 30,000 per person, 60,000 per incident, and 10,000 in property damage. Our per person and per incident limits are on the higher side of minimum limits nationwide, while our property damage limits are generally on the lower side. We also, as Ms. Pompu touched on, have uninsured motorist and underinsured motorist coverage with minimum limits of 25 and 50,000 respectively, or 25 and 50,000 per person per occurrence, which is important because we have an uninsured motorist rate in Minnesota of roughly 11.5%. Minnesota is one of nine states that has mandatory no-fault auto insurance, which means that each insurance company compensates its own policyholders for the cost of minor injuries, regardless of who was at fault in the accident. Our limits for personal injury protection or no fault are 20,000 medical, 20,000 in lost wages, and 5,000 in funeral expenses. You can see the auto premium trend and what it looks like in the state going back to the mid 90s. One of the things I think that sticks out to me and probably does to you as well is the 2005 to 2007, the significant decrease that we saw there. And as we dug in, this was certainly something that stuck out to me. And the response that I got was largely because of the new safety features that had been introduced in vehicles kind of leading into those years.
Mr. Cocking?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that the slides haven't progressed, at least for me. You're on slide 8, is that?
Yes.
I see slide 6.
Okay. Let's see. Let me stop and see if I can try. I'm sorry. How about now?
It's taking a moment. I get a screen saying that it has started screen sharing.
Okay, I think it's in your handout. If you want to refer to that, or I can certainly wait as well. But in respect of your time, I don't want to fool around with the technology. I will refer. It's in your packet, and hopefully it comes back and catches back up. I was referring to the auto premium trends on slide 8 and the decrease that you see in 2005. As I mentioned, one of the reasons we saw that is because of the safety features that are now more prevalent in automobiles. Lane departure warnings, automatic braking, things of that nature, which help to bring down the frequency of accidents. And as I will talk about on the next slide, frequency and severity are the two things that most contribute to rate increases. Simply put, how often and how much a crash costs is really what drives premium. The cost of parts and replacing new vehicles has increased and is increasing significantly, which is also leading to those as well. Next couple charts on your in the packet cover claim frequency and claim severity. And I won't go through those since you don't have the screen up, which is too bad. I'm gonna jump into homeowners insurance then. Your homeowners, this just kicked me out of my screen now. Homeowners insurance generally covers your dwelling or your house, your personal property, other structures such as a shed or a detached garage, liability, medical payments to others, or additional living expenses. Flood insurance is not, however, covered in your homeowner's policy. The trend that we're seeing in Minnesota on the homeowner side, I think, is much more significant. Going back to the mid-90s to where we're at today, we've seen a significant increase, and you can see that in the chart in your packet on slide number 13. And one of the biggest reasons behind that is because Minnesota is an extreme weather state. Hail is the biggest cost driver, both to roofs and siding, as well as windows. We've got ice storms and blizzards in the winter, tornadoes in the spring, summer, and winter. All of those things impact the cost of what insurers are paying out. 1998 was a big change in Minnesota. The total insured losses in Minnesota in 1998 were $1.5 billion, which is $2.4 billion in 2020 numbers. That was more than the 40 previous years combined. And whether this is global climate change or whatever you want to attribute it to, it is certainly true that that weather in Minnesota specifically is becoming more volatile. I'll reference June 2017. Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you remember this well. Major hailstorm in the northern suburbs. $3.2 billion in damage. It was the most expensive storm in Minnesota history. And the 10th most expensive storm in the world in 2017. And so you look from where we were at in 1998 to where we're at with the last numbers, roughly 2016, 2017, certainly increased significantly. So why does this matter? Minnesota is the only state in the country that doesn't allow for weather to be considered in underwriting, which is significant, as companies don't have the option to cancel or non-renew because of these additional threats. People who probably otherwise should go into the Minnesota Fair Plan and have those risks mutualized out across the rest of the industry are potentially having a disproportionate impact on a specific company. You consider, as I said, in 1998, that $368 was the average premium, which put us at 35th highest in the U.S. Today in 2017, the average premium was $1,348, which was 14th highest in the U.S. Contrast that to the average renter's policy in Minnesota of $140, obviously shows, I think, the component of homeowners and the impact that weather has on that. The other line when we talk about personal and commercial is obviously commercial lines insurance, and that's insurance that's needed and designed for businesses, property coverage, liability, commercial auto, workers' compensation, umbrella, specialized liability. All of those are things that that we deal with as well. When someone does not have access or availability to get coverage, we have voluntary market alternatives in the state of Minnesota where you can find coverage that's unavailable in the regular or the admitted market. The automobile insurance plan, the FAIR plan for homeowners, the MJUA or the Minnesota Joint Underwriting Association that takes on liability. Think of that like liquor liability. MJUA is a big part of that, as well as our workers' compensation assigned risk plan. And you can also find coverage in the excess and surplus lines market. Ms. Pompu, as I mentioned before, did a good job of going through kind of how insurance is regulated. We are significantly regulated. We're regulated at the state level based on the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which we appreciate. We believe that legislators in St. Paul and agencies in St. Paul do a better job of knowing what the needs and the issues of Minnesota consumers and policyholders are, more so than a bureaucrat in Washington or Congress would know.
And Mr. Cocky, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but if you could try and wrap up in the next minute or so, I just want to make sure we have enough time for Ms. Rowan and questions before
the turn. Not a problem. I'll just skip ahead. Our laws and rules on licensure policy creation, I think most of you know what we deal with or what you deal with are areas that we're talking about. We have reinsurance available that backs our companies as well as guarantee funds in the event that a company goes insolvent to make sure that those policyholders are taken care of. Significant financial impact to the state in the form of premium taxes, to the local economy and to the economy overall with the number of employees we have. Our insurance companies buy a lot of public bonds, which is important, which we believe all of this results in a strong, healthy, and competitive marketplace, which is what we all want. Thank you again for the opportunity. I look forward to answering any questions. In the meantime, if you've got any questions or issues, feel free to reach out to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking, and thanks for understanding our limited time today. And our next is Robin Rowan of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And thank you for joining us, Ms. Rowan. We're a little behind on schedule, so if you could try and keep your remarks to about 5 minutes, that'd be very helpful so we have time for member questions before the Attorney General.
Will do, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. It's great to be here. I've been a frequent flyer in the Commerce Committee for more years than I actually care to share or admit to myself. But it's good to see new faces here, some old friends, as well as some Commerce alumni who are back, like Representative Dabney and Representative Lilly. I made the perhaps flawed calculation that it would be better for you to see my face than slides. But if you want any additional information about what I'm talking about today, I'll be happy to provide it to you. MIFC, the Minnesota Insurance or Financial Services Council, or MIFC, member life insurance companies help to protect the financial security of Minnesotans every day and through every stage of their life. Every day in Minnesota, life insurers pay out $39.9 million in life and annuity benefits. Nationally, we pay out $2.1 billion daily. And to put that into context, Social Security pays out $2.8 billion. Our products, which all fall under the jurisdiction of this committee, which we agree is the best committee, provide financial solutions for what can be the most difficult and challenging times in people's lives. These solutions include life insurance, which not only protects families, but can also help farmers and small businesses protect their assets for the next generation. Annuities, which are the only private sector product that provides a guaranteed income stream for life. Many middle-income Minnesotans rely on annuities for retirement security. In fact, the median household income for annuity holders is $64,000. There are many different kinds of annuities. I will spare you the annuities 101 talk, but there are two kinds that you should be aware of. Fixed annuities are regulated as insurance products, and variable annuities are regulated as securities. One of the issues you may hear about this session is the need to enhance Minnesota's already stringent fixed annuity consumer protection standards so that consumers have the same strong level of protection, regardless of what type of annuity they buy, whether it's a fixed insurance product or a variable securities product. Our members also write disability income insurance for individuals, large and small employers. DI insurance replaces income if an illness or injury prevents an employee from working. It's been an incredibly critical product during the COVID pandemic. And what is an exciting insurance development, actually might be an oxymoron, exciting insurance development, but we think it is that insurance companies, which largely administered paid family leave programs for large employers, are now able to write paid family leave insurance for small employers that can't afford to self-insure. We originally thought it would be too challenging to underwrite this product, but through partnering with states like New York, we discovered that we can write this product, and we would very much like to begin to offer that product in Minnesota. We also write long-term care insurance. Long-term care issues probably could fill a hearing on its own, but the industry, while we still have the rating issues of the past, have really figured out now how to price it accurately. And they're no longer your grandmother or grandfather's long-term care policies. They don't just cover nursing homes. They cover home care as well as assisted living. You can buy hybrid products that pair long-term care insurance with life insurance and annuities. So there's a benefit if you don't use it. So there's a lot to talk about there. I'm happy to do that when we have time. You may not know this, but Minnesota has an incredibly robust domestic life insurance industry. Aaron touched on the fact that domestic doesn't mean US-based. It means the insurance company's home state. So a state based in Wisconsin, but selling insurance in Minnesota is considered foreign. Even though they're not essentially a foreign company, although some people might think Wisconsin is a foreign country anyway. So we have 9 domestic life insurance companies. These include Securian Financial, which has been based in downtown St. Paul for 149 years. Across the river, we have, in downtown Minneapolis, we have Ameriprise. Allianz is in Golden Valley. Minnesota is also home to several fraternal insurers. Fraternals are a special insurer. They're not-for-profit, and they're membership and mission-based. We also have Sons of Norway as a fraternal. and they're in Uptown, and Catholic United, which is in Arden Hills. Thrivent is the biggest fraternal, and they're located in downtown Minneapolis. They're actually you would consider them a foreign company because they're based in Wisconsin, but we still love them, and their corporate headquarters is here. We have 53,000 jobs that we support in the state, and it doesn't include all of the agents and financial advisors that we have in every corner of the state running their small businesses and working with consumers. Aaron talked a little bit about how we're regulated. Because we have such a strong domestic life insurance industry, the Department of Commerce is absolutely critical to us. And it is essential that we have a properly resourced, well-functioning Department of Commerce. If we don't, as a domestic industry, it impairs our ability to compete nationally and even multinationally. So it's absolutely critical for us. That's why we're happy that this committee now is also a budget committee, so that the people that are delving into and understand the policy are also looking at the budget. I think sometimes we get overshadowed when we were in jobs and energy by our somewhat sexier sibling, the energy industry. So I went through that pretty fast, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions and talk about any insurance issues anytime with any of you. Thank you.
I'm very grateful, Ms. Rowan, for your speed there and your time constraints. We do have about a dozen minutes for member questions. I will be turning over to the Attorney General at 4 o'clock. I do have a question for Mr. Cocking. You talked about the increase in severe weather events in Minnesota and mentioned that in 2017, that hailstorm, which my city, the city of Coon Rapids, had to use snowplows to clear the hail off the streets in Coon Rapids, was the 10th most expensive event in the world. I know that there has been some discussion about how climate change is already increasing the cost of homeowners insurance for Minnesotans in the Department of Commerce and elsewhere. And it's a strong concern of mine is mitigating the effects of climate change that's already occurring. Can you speak to whether there are projections that your organization has done or some of your members have done about if uncontrolled, what kind of impact climate change will have on homeowner insurance claims and rates over the next decade or so?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, good question. I won't speak maybe necessarily to the issue of climate change per se, but one of the things I think that we are looking at is how do we build more resilient buildings to withstand, these changing weather, which is, I think, undeniable. Now, what the source of that is beyond my scope and what I'm going to talk about. But I think, you know, it is a factor. The fact that the hailstorms are becoming more dramatic, that we're seeing heavier snow loads in the wintertime, the winds that are blowing. I think the key focus of our industry is how do we build houses that are more resilient to withstand what this changing weather looks like? Because by doing so, if you're able to build a more resilient house and you don't have those losses incurred, that does a good thing for everybody's premium.
And just to follow up on that, it's fair to say that these increased in severe weather events have increased premium costs over the past few years for Minnesota homeowners and will continue to increase them if nothing changes in years to come.
I think that's a fair statement.
Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was also for Mr. Cocking. Mr. Cocking, related actually to that similar topic that the chair just had brought up, as a general contractor and as one who's done multiple renovations and improvements to real estate, one of the things that I've observed is the dramatic increase in the cost of supplies. And I'm sure that's probably for an array of reasons, but one of them is, I mean, that can be experienced right now in 2020, 2021, which is I go to the lumber stores, the stores, and many of the shelves that I'm looking for the products are sparse or empty. So when it comes to the number that you cited, the record number of payouts in like 2017, in my mind, I'm thinking the incredible demand that we've had in new construction, trying to satisfy after we've come out of the Great Recession and then the huge demand for home ownership and the lack of single family homes and all of the demand that's occurring, how much does that impact the payout claim on your behalf? Because as I'm, you know, on all the properties I have, they're all insured at replacement cost. And so if something gets damaged, like a hailstorm 2 years ago that I went through, I had 11 roofs that I had to replace. And I know that the cost of the shingles in 2020 were significantly more expensive than the roofs that I replaced in 2009. So it is, my question is, in the raw number that you're citing in 2017, that's smack dab in the middle of the increase in supplies. Is that factored into what you're citing?
Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, without a doubt. I mean, anytime you have additional payouts, which as I referenced before, go to the severity portion of a payout, more expensive materials absolutely contribute to obviously higher costs. And as a result of those higher costs, those have to be collected or reflected in higher premiums. And we live in a global market, or at least a North American marketplace. As we see hurricanes go through and ravage kind of our coastal areas, we see an increase then in the cost of plywood and other lumber and other supplies that certainly impacts Minnesota, and that certainly impacts the costs and by extension, the premiums that policyholders have to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Cocking, for mentioning the global markets. It's my understanding, and I won't ask you to comment on this, but that a significant source of the construction material increase in cost is due to the functioning of the global markets, in particular federal trade policy, which of course is far beyond the jurisdiction of this committee. But Representative Lucero, did you have a follow-up, or was that?
No follow-up question, but just a quick comment, and that would be, we need to be cognizant that when we're talking about the price that insurance are having to do for their payout, that is competing with the limited supply for the new construction for those very same materials that are being used to replace versus build new construction. That obviously has an impact on the insurance payout. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very true, Representative Lucero, that the high cost of construction materials driven by federal trade policy and other variables is impacting multiple segments of the economy. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be okay to ask Ms. Pampu a question?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question related for House Research. During her overview, she mentioned dental insurance. And I've often wondered on dental insurance why it just doesn't seem to cover that much. So is that something that we would set in this policy or this committee versus an healthcare committee? You know, if I have a car and I happen to get in an accident, it just seems like the outcome is kind of clear, the pathway. We know what the deductible is, or even what Representative Lucero was talking about with his roofs. You kind of know what you're signing up for and then you get. But it just seems like dental care that you don't get much bang for the buck. And so I think people think they have dental insurance, and it just doesn't seem like it's doing much. So I have more of a statement there too, but I also have a question. So if she could kind of answer, is that set in this committee or is that in a healthcare committee? And how do we do it?
Chair and members, we have historically regulated dental insurance. It is a small part within the health insurance statutes. And I'm happy to talk about, because it's come up perennially, how little dental insurance costs and why it may be priced that way. You will notice that dental insurance is very inexpensive. So they get a lot of people to join dental insurance because it has very low premiums. There have been discussions about having a more comprehensive product, but perhaps the people that will buy the comprehensive product will only be the people that need a lot of care. So, you know, there's just discussions about pricing and premiums and who would sign up, and it's certainly an idea. I'm always available.
Very much looking forward to the 2021 Leon Lilly Comprehensive Dental Insurance Reform Package. Representative Lilly, did you have a follow-up?
No, it would just be nice. I happen to know someone intimately that works for a major airline that's considering dental tourism, and it would be really nice to be able to do some of my dental care. And I've heard this from others in Minnesota. Thank you.
And forgive me, Representative Lilly, I totally agree with you that that is a subject that is ripe for discussion. I don't see any additional questions at this time. So we will invite the Attorney General into Zoom. And while we were doing that, I will just comment to the committee. This is something that I will probably repeat at various times throughout session. You know, we do have a very broad jurisdiction in this committee, but it is not limitless. I will ask for members at times to try and keep their attention, comments, and questions to the subject matter at hand. And while we have the Attorney General with us today to talk about his office's consumer protection functions, I would ask that members try and keep the conversation focused on that, because that is where our jurisdiction is, and it's a subject that deserves our full attention, as tempting as it might be to talk about any of the other great issues that the Attorney General has to do with. So with that, it's my pleasure to welcome to the committee the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota.
Well, Chair Stevenson, I just want to say thank you, and thank you to all the committee members. The issue of consumer justice and consumer fairness is critically important. You know, the fact is that businesses that are fair with their consumers and treat everyone honestly should not be at a disadvantage from businesses that don't treat their consumers fairly. And certainly consumers in this tough economy need every penny that they earn and every penny that they can use in order to take care of their families. So I'm pleased to talk about the topic. Let me just say that the Attorney General has broad and comprehensive statutory authority and common law authority as well to investigate and enforce violations of Minnesota laws, quote, respecting unfair, discriminatory, and other unlawful practices in business, commerce, and trade, unquote. That's a quote from Minnesota Statute 8.31, Subdivision 1, promulgated by the legislature many years ago, and has broad authority. It's basically, it is a codification of the Attorney General's parens patriae authority, which is just a Latin term, which means that the Attorney General's job is to bring lawsuits and defend the interests of the people of the state. As you may know, every single state in Minnesota, every single state in the union has an Attorney General, and eight territories do as well. 43 of them are elected, 48 of them serve independently, and there are a few that are selected by the governor, but that's in the minority. Our federal government, the president picks the Attorney General. In nearly 43 states, the Attorney General is elected by the people. That's an important distinction. We have what's called as a divided executive branch. Examples of the work that we're doing to advance the economic justice and commerce for Minnesotans include just a few things that I'll bring to light. One is the unlicensed and usurious lending in violation of chapters 56 and 334. Cases that we brought under this area are State versus Minnesota School of Business. This is a case in which exorbitant interest rates and unlicensed student loans were issued to students by for-profit college. That same college told students that if they came there and studied, that they could become law enforcement officers. But only problem is that this Minnesota School of Business was not credited to issue that degree. And so that was fraud. We took them to court and we got money back for people who were defrauded. Another example is Cash Call, Inc. State versus Cash Call, that's a case we brought. In that case, the company was using a third-party company as a front to issue exorbitant payday loans to Minnesota consumers. It's against the law, and we took them to court. Another one, State versus Future Income Payments, LLC. In that case, the company was disguising its exorbitant interest rates and illegal interest rates and unlicensed loans to veterans as a purchase contract of their future pension benefits. So they were essentially depriving people who put their lives on the line for our country, and that is something we cannot tolerate. Another category of work that we do is in student loan debt and tax debt relief scams in violation of Minnesota Statute 332B. So there, the Attorney General settled and continues to investigate numerous companies for collecting hefty upfront fees from students in exchange for deceptive promises that they will reduce their student loan debt. In reality, Often, this consists of the company just completing tasks that the student could do for free with the Department of Education. And so we put a stop to that. An example is State versus Wall and Associates, where we stopped them from collecting large fees from tax debt burden consumers in violation of 332B and misrepresentations regarding services and results to consumers. Another category, Mr. Chairman and members, is unfair and deceptive trade practices by insurance agents. An example is State versus American Family Mutual. In that case, insurance agents were misrepresenting coverage to homeowners and under insurance policies. You know, everybody has to be honest. That is an important part of our free market economy, is good information and honest dealing. We work to ensure that. Another example is State versus Allianz Life Insurance Company, where we brought an action to stop insurance agents from selling deferred annuities to seniors that were not suitable for them and misrepresenting in terms of terms and conditions of the annuity. So we stepped up and dealt with that. Another category, Mr. Chairman, is the unlawful debt collection practices. Another example of that is State versus Global Gateway Solutions. Our lawyers in that case brought action against unlicensed debt collector, collecting phantom debts. These are debts that don't exist. You're saying you owe money, pay up. And some people did pay up because they didn't know. And so they were made threatening, high pressure tactics. A lot of this aimed at seniors and vulnerable consumers. And so while the Commission of Commerce also has statutory authority to enforce many unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade, the commissioner's authority is not exclusive. And the attorney general also has such authority, which we use under 8.31 to the benefit of Minnesota consumers and small business people. The attorney general may also investigate suspected violations of these and other laws relating to unlawful practices in commerce under section 8.31 by engaging in pre-suit discovery. That those of you who are familiar with our legal system know that you have to file a lawsuit, then you do discovery. The attorney general availability of civil investigative demands. We can do a discovery before we file a lawsuit. And we do that in order to try to get to the bottom of situations and resolve them if we can. On becoming satisfied that there have been or will be violations, the attorney general is entitled to bring an enforcement action, and we do. In such enforcement actions, the attorney general has authority to obtain injunctive relief, civil penalties in the amount to be determined by a court, up to $25,000 per violation, restitution or disgorgement. That means illegally obtained profits or basically ill-gotten gains, and costs and reasonable attorney's fees and other equitable relief as determined by the court. The attorney general may also recover any penalties or remedies provided by the law that is being violated as well. Examples of that include courts recognized in state could seek remedies outlined in section 8.31 in addition to those in chapter 56. So let me just wrap up, Mr. Chairman, and stand for questions. You know, we have a number of priorities in the area of business, commerce, and trade. Our bread and butter is the fraud, the typical fraud case, or, you know, the company might tack on an extra fee that was never explained to the customer. We brought cases against CenturyLink and Comcast, Frontier and others, all of which had to do with a lack of transparency in pricing, promises not met, things like that. I'd like you to know, Mr. Chairman, I'd like the members to know that we received 85,000 cases, calls in 2020. We have a number, and you can call it 651-296-3353, or you can go to ag.state.mn.us. We have our complaint forms that are on the website, and we look forward to helping consumers. Areas that we hear a lot of complaints about are prescription drug prices. We used the AG's authority to have a pharmaceutical Drug Pricing Task Force, which came up with a number of recommendations, including litigation, administrative remedies, and legislative ideas, all to try to make sure that Minnesotans could afford the drugs that people rely on, including insulin. And then also another one of our priorities is antitrust lawsuits. If you look at American markets today, they are far more concentrated than they have been in any time in the last 50, 60 years. It's not, you know, the blame lies in many places. It's bipartisan in many ways. Neither Democrat or Republican administrations have really taken antitrust action the way they should, in my opinion. And the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act passed many years ago, 100 years ago, are still good law. And, you know, the markets are so concentrated in agriculture, in big tech. Everybody talks about big tech today, but there are many other highly concentrated markets as well. You should know that we have lost, since 2017, 810 dairy farms in Minnesota. I'm very concerned about that. And I want to make sure that every dairy farmer who wants to be out there producing dairy products for us is able to have a small operation. You shouldn't have to get big or get out. And that means we've got to have strong antitrust litigation, and that's right in the wheelhouse of your committee. Let me also add tenant protection. We've found that housing is an essential thing that everyone needs. You know, if you don't have enough food, you might be able to go to a food shelf. And if you don't have enough medicine, maybe you can find somebody who can help you get some. But if you don't have anywhere to live, you are in the street, and that puts everything at risk. That's why we believe that tenant protection and being there and housing is an important place for us to operate, and we have done that. And then finally, wage theft. We started a wage theft unit because we saw just a large number of hardworking Minnesotans who put in all their time that they were contracted to do, and yet their paychecks were short. And it was happening so often that we felt we needed a wage theft unit to really enforce that people would get all the wages that they have earned. We've been working with our prosecutorial partners, because wage theft is also a crime, and there have been criminal prosecutions, but we've taken civil action. And the truth is, Mr. Chairman, we have way more cases that people want us to do than we have lawyers to put on them. And so we're well overprescribed at this point. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and let you know that I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Again, we're very grateful to have you with us today, and very grateful for your office's consumer protection efforts, which Minnesotans have valued for many decades now. Members can ask questions by, again, raising your hand in the Zoom feature. I did have a question for you, Mr. Attorney General. You know, I'm so glad that you mentioned both the volume of calls that you receive, as well as the student loan real crisis that we have, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. I'm often fond of pointing out to people that student loan debt is now the second largest type of debt in the United States, surpassing credit card debt, second only to mortgage debt by the total amount outstanding. And I wonder if you, as we see that level of debt increase, if you are experiencing more and more complaints from consumers about, or confusion from consumers about how their student loan operates and what rights they have under the law.
Yes, I can give you the exact numbers at a later time. I don't have them at my fingertips, but we get a lot of calls about student loan debt. In particular, we were part of action against Navient. As you, some of you may know, Navient is a student loan processor, and there is a federal, well, there was a federal program where if you worked in a public institution, you're supposed to be able to put in a debt reduction, debt forgiveness program. Instead, Navient would direct people to what's called loan deferment, where their loans would just continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And people were not able to get into a program to really get those loans down. And we were part of a multi-state group to take action on them. And of course, I already mentioned the Minnesota School of Business Globe College. So this is a growing area, unfortunately. And it really undermines young couples, in particular young people, family formation being delayed, people not buying houses and dishwashers, but instead just feeding back those student loan debt. And there's a lot of deception and there's a lot of poor and misinformation. So we're committed to do something about it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Attorney General. And to add to your list of the societal impacts, the Federal Reserve Bank did a study showing it's one of the most significant reasons why people leave Greater Minnesota and for the metro area. So it's impacting our population distribution among the state, people leaving the Greater Minnesota to come to the city to help pay off their student loans. Vice Chair Katisa Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Mr. Attorney General, for being with us today. I just wanted to touch base on, I know earlier at the, more toward the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in the spring, you were receiving lots of reports about price gouging. And I want to thank you for taking action against those issues. And I'm hopeful that, you know, now the toilet paper supply seems to be steadied among other products that are certainly necessary for people living their day-to-day lives during the pandemic. But I'm just curious if you had an update as kind of how that's proceeded throughout the rest of the year as we, or last year, as we continue working through the pandemic.
Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you're right. We had a really big onset of essential items like N95 masks, hand sanitizer, toilet tissue. That went on for a good solid 6 to 8 weeks. Then it curtailed. Now we're still pretty busy, but our largest problem is housing. You know, there is a eviction moratorium, and I like to explain to people, it's not a complete moratorium. If you're committing crimes, if you're being dangerous, and if you're putting people at risk, or if you own property and your family wants to move in with you and you need to make room, those are all things that are legal justifications to evict someone. But other reasons at this point are not. We've had some really egregious cases where we've had people's utilities shut off, people who are vulnerable and sick who, you know, we've had the landlord barge into their units. And we've had to do a lot of enforcement in that area. We've only had to sue a few people, only a few, but we've had to educate a lot of folks. And I'm glad you asked about this, Representative, because generally speaking, we don't have to take people to a court. You know, usually, I mean, like more than 90% of the cases that we get, we can talk the parties through it, through education, sharing with them what the law requires. In a few cases, we have to take people to court. And quite frankly, we haven't had to do that in a while. So things are getting better on that front. We still get a lot of calls, though, about routine everyday things. A lot of online scamming goes on, you know, phishing scams. You know, somebody called, I mean, I bet everybody on this call has gotten a call saying your Social Security is about to be cut off and got to call this number now and all these kind of things. And so it's our job to try to stop that. We work with a U.S. attorney to do that because their internet capabilities are much greater than ours. But we work together and hopefully we do some people some good.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Attorney General Ellison, I've been serving on the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council for the past year, I believe. And I know we get updates about the lawsuit against some of the pharma companies, and was just wondering if you could give the committee a little bit of an update about where that lawsuit is, and any information you could share with us would be great.
Mr. Attorney General.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. I get regular briefings from my staff, and I got to be honest with you, Representative. I haven't talked to them since last week, so I don't know what happened since about last Wednesday till today. But we've been fairly close to some negotiations with regard to Purdue and the Sacklers. We put a number in front of them. We're waiting for them to call back. The fact is that this is not an easy thing. And we think that we have an agreement. We have a proposal, and we're waiting to hear back from them. Their original proposal was about $3 billion. $4 billion based on sales. Ours is significantly higher than that. As you may have heard from the press, they have overseas assets to far exceeding the settlement amount, all obtained, in my view, improperly by selling a drug that they knew was highly addictive, causing massive loss of life. Also, you should know that one of the features that Minnesota was really aggressive about was disclosure. We were arguing that, look, there can be no settlement. We won't settle unless you tell the truth and tell the whole story. There's not going to be any sort of non-disclosure agreement where you don't tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and set up a repository of documents so that anybody can go through and see what you did to try to addict people. And so that is a part of the proposal as well. We should hear something in the next several weeks, because that proposal we put out there has been out there for a while. But at this point, we have a multi-billion dollar proposal to settle. We think they should do it because it would resolve the matter. I don't think that dollar amount would be justice, because they still would be able to keep some of the money that they earned in an improper way. But it would bring significantly more relief to victims, and would also provide that disclosure that I just mentioned. And if you'd like, Representative Kegel, I could certainly have a direct briefing from my staff to tell you up to date, to the minute, where the negotiations are. You let me know if you want that.
That would be great. Okay. And thank you, Chair Stevenson. And that would be great. And I'd also like to kind of talk through some ideas about families who have, you know, spent personal funds on treatment and recovery. That's something that my family went through. My mom is still paying off my brother's, you know, treatment and recovery fees, or, you know, charges. And so I think that also needs to be considered in when some of that lawsuit money comes in. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And if I may say so, Mr. Chairman, you know, my attitude about this whole settlement is that when we get our proper allotment, that the money should go to the victims. Should go to the family, should go to the county, should go to the cities, should go to the hospitals, should go to the places where the losses were inflicted. I'm hoping that the money just doesn't devolve somewhere into the general fund and doesn't go to the people who really need it in order to recover. That's my hope. But of course, my job is to get the settlement. Your job is to decide what happens after that.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for spending some time with us today. I have a comment and then a question. First, the comment. Circling back to the higher education fraud that you were discussing, I just want to thank you for your efforts in that area. As somebody who spent over 12 years in as a student myself in higher education, with obtaining 3 2-year degrees, 2 bachelor degrees, 2 minors and a master's, and then going on to teach college myself for 7 years, I have a high disdain for practices that would deceive those that are seeking to better themselves and make the sacrifice that an incredible effort. So I just want to thank you for that, because we definitely, people need to, who are going to make the effort and the sacrifice to go to school, need to know that they're going to graduate with a degree that is able to be used here in the state of Minnesota and is applicable in other places.
Agreed.
For my question, it pertains to actually something you touched on, big tech. So we've all seen recent activities in regards to big tech. We've seen people by the thousands being kicked off, reports of that being kicked off certain platforms, social media platforms. We've seen deplatforming completely by other large tech companies. You had referenced anti-competitive or consumer protection or anti-monopolistic behavior. I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts, or have you, or it might be too early, but have you considered anything that might be a threat that we've seen, might be a threat to Minnesotans in terms of, as somebody who's in technology now, and as somebody who operates in the technology field, I have a concern because Amazon, for example, and when you combine Amazon and Microsoft, Amazon's AWS, Microsoft's Azure, right, they have a significant monopoly and market share in the hosted data center space. And when we see certain actions being performed, I just want to make sure that Minnesotans are protected. So thank you, Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Attorney General.
Well, Representative Lucero, thanks for bringing that to my attention. We share our concern about monopolization and market concentration, because what it really brings with it is like just tons of power. Tons of power to buy innovative ideas and then just shelve them, you know. tons of power to limit the number of startups and IPOs that we otherwise might have, power to set wages, power to say who gets on the platform and who doesn't. And so I gotta tell you that I've seen some news reports about what you speak of. I don't know enough about it to offer a really intelligent view, but I'm, like I said, I'm more than happy to talk with you about that if this is an issue of concern for you. It certainly is for me. And I think that more and more people are starting to wake up to the fact that our markets, whether they're big tech or agriculture or beer or whatever, or meat, are highly concentrated, and it is not to the benefit of the consumer, workers, or small business people, or farmers.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General. And my time in office here, I really have been trying to move and bring part of the conversation technology, because I personally believe that it's not a partisan issue at all. And one of the things that I started when I first got into office 6 years ago, but I think has become more and more of an issue on a different topic, would be deepfake, or the ability to, that we're seeing technology being able to capture people's images, videos, or audio recordings and completely manufacture them using artificial intelligence. And that is a huge threat to people, whether you're a public figure or not. But it's a very narrow threading of the needle that has to take place, because we don't want to cross the lines of First Amendment free speech and things like that. So I definitely would love to work with your office and any on this or any technology related topics, because we, again, definitely want to get in front of this, because as I've been saying in bill hearings on this, on the deepfake bill that I've had, every year that goes by, the ability to manufacture video or audio or pictures of people continues to become more and more available, and soon it'll be just available on any mobile phone and anybody can do it. And then all of us become potential targets of revenge porn or manufactured revenge porn or all kinds of stuff. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair and Attorney General.
Thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for your time today. I know, as you mentioned, your office receives a lot of complaints that are filed by Minnesotans, and your office is tasked with processing those complaints. I was wondering, Mr. Attorney General, if you could talk about some of the metrics or information that you and your team look at to determine how well your office is doing at processing and responding to those complaints in regard to your consumer protection work. And what that information tells you about how your office is doing in that regard.
Mr. Attorney General.
This is an excellent question. And the truth is, Representative, I can share with you what I know, but we've had an ongoing series of meetings talking about how our instruments of measurement are not good enough. You know, I asked them, so where are the calls coming from? So what time are we getting the calls? Is there a way that we can use, if we get a bunch of calls in a certain area, that we might be able to build a lawsuit out of the calls? And right now we do that, but it's essentially anecdotal. It's like, you know, we get around and talk and say, hey, we got a bunch of calls from XYZ. Oh, yeah, let's do something. But what if we did it a little more scientific way based on the numbers? So the truth is, we're going through some technology improvements to do exactly what you are recommending. We're not where I'd like to be, but let me tell you what I know. The fact is that we answer calls within about 5 seconds, right? If you call, you're gonna talk to somebody. We do turn off the phone sometimes, because as you may imagine, being on the phones 9 hours a day is not for the faint of heart, right? That's a position where we see a lot of burnout, quite honestly. And so that's a concern for us. We're looking at how to get people to not just have to be on the phones all day and do other things. We do know that we are able to capture when, if we get the right name entered into the into our network, we can track the frequent flyers, right? So we can do that. And actually, there's more data to give you. The manager of that division, great guy named Parker Mertz, gives me a regular report. And today I wish I would have had more information to share with you. I can tell you that we do track the information. We do ask data like, what county are you from? I cannot tell you that today because I just don't have it at my fingertips. We ask data like information like, clearly, what's your topic? But like, say, for example, one of our workers entered Comcast Inc. and somebody else just entered Comcast. They would be counted as two different entries. We need to figure out really how often we see the frequent flyers, where the concentrations are. We do collect age data when people voluntarily share it. Of course, you know that we're careful about collecting demographic data because we certainly don't want anybody to think that we're playing favorites, you know what I mean? Or any group is disfavored. But that demographic information, when people are comfortable volunteering it, it's really helpful because it lets us know who's being concentrated. We know that seniors are a high target area, particularly for some of the online scams and computer scams and Social Security scams and grandparent scams. So the truth is we are collecting that data. I'm not prepared to talk about it right now the way I'd like to. But again, we'd be happy to follow up with you and give you some specifics. But the main point is we need to do better at disaggregating the data to really figure out what we're looking at and what we're getting.
I think we have time for one, maybe two more questions. I'm going to try and squeeze in the two members that have questions on the block here. Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for being here. First, I have a comment and then a question. And you were a part and you witnessed one of the projects up north, and you saw over a period of time, years and years of false promises and the communities and labor and businesses being held with the bag. And we do have a project that got another 6-month extension, as you know. But my fear is, and when we talk about commerce, and you mentioned it earlier in your statement, that we support strong, viable companies that do the right thing the right way and treat their Absolutely. Communities. Right. And so my Yep. question is, how are we going to track? How are we going to measure that we are not going down the same path and we're not being lied and deceived in 6 months? How are we going to verify the information that they are providing us so we're not a dog returning to its vomit over and over again in the communities, labor, and business of that region be held with the bag?
Mr. Attorney General.
Well, Representative, this issue mostly comes to my attention as a member of the, on the executive council, this issue came up. And I did support further investigation on this matter. There was a motion to table so we could learn more, and that was defeated. What I will tell you is that when this issue comes up again, I really want to encourage you to call me and let me know your experience as you witness it and your constituents witness it. Because the truth is, I understand how important this project is. It should get done, needs to get done. And there are other people who might be available to do it. So all I can tell you is that I don't know exactly how we'll measure the current, the incumbent's progress, but I want to encourage you to let me know what you think about it when the moment arrives, when we have to decide.
Well, thank you,
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General, because you did ask questions and you were transparent in wanting all the information, and I thank you for caring for our region.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Lislegard. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I understand the last question was actually Representative O'Driscoll alerting me to a House GOP caucus at 4:30. And so we won't have any further questions. Just thank you for your time and your service to the state. Thank the members, and we'll adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.